Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If passed by Congress, it would be the biggest bailout in U.S. history. Today, the Bush administration announced a plan to buy hundreds of billions of dollars in bad loans from banks. These are mainly mortgage-backed securities whose value plummeted as the housing market sank. President Bush called the move unprecedented and said it does include risks.
These measures will require us to put a significant amount of taxpayer dollars on the line. This action does entail risk, but we expect that this money will eventually be paid back.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson called the loans that would be bailed out under the plan toxic assets. He said they're clogging up the financial system and preventing banks from loaning money.
I am convinced that this bold approach will cost American families far less than the alternative. A continuing series of financial institution failures and frozen credit markets unable to fund economic expansion.
The Treasury also said it would temporarily guarantee money market funds. We'll have more on that later in the program. But what's the latest? Sudeep Reddy is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and blogger for Real Time Economics. And Sudeep, first of all, what does all this mean? We know mortgages have been bundled together and sold and resold, raising money on paper for investors. But when then people defaulted on those mortgages, the house of cards fell. But what does this government plan mean? What will the government buy? What will they do with it?
Well, this is really a decade of bad decisions by the government in terms of regulation, leading to the market breakdown that we saw, and now the government this week being faced with a series of very bad choices to select from. And so the government is really trying to step in and segregate the part, the toxic assets, the part of the market that has been the kind of the core, the source of this problem over the past 13 months.
These bad loans, these foreclosed on homes, but what do they plan to do with those mortgages?
So the idea is to get them off the books of banks and other financial institutions that are seeing their own their stock values and everything else about them being weighed down by concerns about the exposure to these mortgages. So they've got them sitting on their books, and firms are unwilling to trade in many cases with other banks because they're fearing exposure to that. You saw some banks fail already.
Right. So the government's going to use American taxpayer money to buy these up and what, just hold them, just sort of freeze them for a while, get them out of the marketplace?
The idea is exactly to get them out of the marketplace so they're not kind of leading to this problem where you're just waiting for the next firm to collapse, and you get them out of the marketplace, you park them somewhere else, and really what you're looking for is for the housing market to find a bottom. The one reason you've had this problem is you haven't been able to value the mortgages because you don't know ultimately what houses are going to be worth. And so once the housing market finds a bottom, which could be sometime between the coming spring and the end of the year, you will be able to actually start valuing those mortgages a little bit more, and you would know a little bit more about how much they're worth. So a lot of the big details now to be worked out is how do you value them to take them off these company books. They've already been written down a lot, so they're clearly worth less than they were when they originated, but those are some of the critical decisions that need to be made so that the people who created the problem by creating these mortgages on Wall Street aren't the ones who are also benefiting from it right now.
And by the way, this doesn't mean that people can just stop paying their mortgages, right? These are already, you know, foreclosed on.
Exactly. So what happened is these are, in many cases, mortgage securities. So people will have created, gotten their mortgages, and then banks have taken those mortgages up and chopped them into various kinds of assets and securities, and so sold them off again. And so it's those that are linked to the mortgages themselves, but obviously everybody has to continue paying their mortgage because
right.
They don't have their own individual case.
And Sudeep, in the minute we have, we understand that, you know, of course, Congress has to sign off on this. Already we're hearing that Senator Chris Dodd is saying we want more details. Candidate John McCain is saying the government should stop doing bailouts, his reaction to today's announcements. How tough is this going to be in just the few seconds we have?
It's obviously an unprecedented action. You're looking at least several hundred billion dollars. There are some private sector estimates this morning that are saying $1 trillion, which is obviously a stunning figure. But the question is what Congress is willing to do if it doesn't stop this. And so when you have the markets and the economy basically staring down the potential for another Great Depression, though obviously we're not anywhere near that point yet, but the potential for it is what's forcing Congress to have to make a decision now on whether it wants to take a risk here and let markets continue to melt down or step in and do something decisive.
Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal. By the way, we're just hearing that Barack Obama says he supports the Bush plan. We'll continue to look at this. Sudeep, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we want to take a break from the bad economic news, but not from important news. Earlier this week, Oprah used her show to push for passage of the Protect Our Children Act. The U.S. Senate is considering this bill, which would pump $320 million into an effort to track down child sexual predators and fight child pornography on the Internet. Well, for our next guest, that legislation is years too late. On a hot summer day in 1976, Melanie Perkins was playing with her friends at the Higgins Memorial Pool in Lawrence, Massachusetts. She wanted to go home, so she asked a friend, 10-year-old Andy Puglisi, to walk with her. He wanted to stay at the pool across the street from the low-income stadium housing projects where they lived. So she left alone and never saw him again. Andy went missing, and in 1998, Melanie Perkins went back to Lawrence to try to find him. Her investigation is documented in the HBO film Have You Seen Andy? It's up for an Emmy on Monday night. A warning here. This is going to be a difficult conversation to listen to at times, but as we said, an important one, as Melanie Perkins joins us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What a troubling film to watch. Take us back to 1976. How did you feel as a child when Andy disappeared? And what was the attitude then towards missing kids?
We didn't think there was any such thing as missing children. Nobody had ever heard of anything like that. And I had a crush on Andy that summer. He had just moved into the projects, and he was a handsome boy and had a great personality. He was very friendly to kids. And we didn't think anything of it until we started to hear people start to call his name and ask us if, you know, we had seen Andy. The police came to our house in the middle of the night. Mm. I think at first I thought he had probably gone somewhere and he was going to get in trouble. They would find him. But in the morning when we woke up and he still wasn't there, I think I realized it was a lot more serious. And one of the things that I remember being really remarkable was that the housing projects really consisted of a lot of adults who were survivors, a lot of single moms. And I remember as a little girl seeing those people who I had known as real fighters scared. They had a look on their face that I know I'll never forget.
You mentioned having a crush on Andy. That comes as great comfort to Andy's mother, who you go back to visit with years later as you start to make your documentary. And also comforting was the fact that you cared and remembered. Let's listen.
I thought, wow, Andy had a girlfriend. He impacted your life. I'm not alone with my search. I'm not alone with my longing for answers and missing of Andy.
Andy's mom, Faith, one of the survivors you talk about, she had a whole bunch of kids. She seemed devoted to them. How would you characterize the search for Andy? Even the first night, she says cops told her they couldn't look until he was missing for a day. This was common back then. Kids were thought to be runaways. But the search was abandoned after 5 or 6 days. Was it botched?
Andy's mom had separated from his Italian-American father and now had a biracial child, a baby, his baby sister, whom he loved so much, Mandy, and was pregnant again. And that was a big deal in the 70s. And so I think that the police sort of automatically looked down at Faith.
You know, I wondered about that because, you know, this was here in Massachusetts during the time when the school busing controversy was raging right over in Boston.
Exactly.
So I wondered about that.
The projects was primarily white. I can remember the one black family that was in this South Lawrence part of the projects.
In fact, tell us a little bit about these projects in Massachusetts as far as, you know, what kind of a place they were for kids to grow up.
I loved living in the stadium projects. We had a couple of hundred kids living there. It was like a big playground. And the thing was, most of us weren't supervised. I like to say it was a little bit Stand By Me and a little bit Lord of the Flies. You know, it was survival of the fittest. But at the same time, we were surviving together.
And the pool was right across the street. So you all just went back and forth by yourselves, as Andy did. You got some of your friends together 10 years ago when you went back to Lawrence and began thinking about this search for Andy. Here's them talking about him and growing up there and the search.
I liked Andy and we hung out. But I was a little mad because I liked you. and you liked him. And that bugged me.
I can remember, too, a lot of the kids playing a part in the search themselves.
And all the kids got together in the woods and held hands and walked, like, through the thick grass and stuff like that, looking for him, calling his name and stuff like that, yeah.
There was a whole community of children that were really affected by his disappearance, and it affects our parenting today. It affects the way we view our world, and they're all still deeply traumatized by what happened that day.
Well, after the authorities stopped their search, the story of Andy would reappear as a news story. Psychics got involved. In the late 70s, a woman named Elaine Nowacki claimed to be channeling Andy's voice. The Lawrence police actually then hired their own psychic who gave them clues to start a dig near the pool, but the police called that off because of the media attention. Let's advance the story. Andy's case is eventually reopened. Were you a part of it reopening?
Mm-hmm. After I started actually filming, Andy's brother had suggested it might be smart to go to the newspapers. Maybe we'd get some tips on what happened to him, set up a P.O. box so people could write to me anonymously. And I did that, and sure enough, anonymous tips started coming into the P.O. box. People who had remembered Andy disappearing came into the P.O. box. And that's what reopened the investigation. It was the media attention on the filming of the documentary, I think, that got the police interested in reopening the investigation. Part of it was because I was getting new tips and new information. So there was new evidence for the police to look at.
Well, and there was also old evidence that seemed to have been overlooked. You find a letter in Andy's file that says a prison inmate confessed to killing a young boy in Lawrence, Massachusetts. This inmate was Charles Pierce, already in prison for killing a 10-year-old girl from Boxford, Massachusetts, just 10 miles from Lawrence. He died, but before dying, as we said, he confessed to killing a boy from Lawrence, and he knew a man named Wayne Chapman. Now, you and others believe Wayne Chapman is a prime suspect in Andy's disappearance. That name's familiar in this area, but tell people across the country, who's Wayne Chapman?
Wayne W. Chapman is a serial sex offender who was convicted of raping two little boys who I also knew and grew up with in the Lawrence area the summer before Andy disappeared. Unfortunately, Wayne Chapman wasn't arrested until 2 weeks after Andy disappeared, and even then it was only for a traffic violation. When they did finally pull him over and search his van, they found that there were several reasons to suspect him of many missing children across the country. Chapman has never been charged with the abduction or murder of any of those children, but he was long considered a suspect. What I found remarkable was that I learned there were 5 known pedophiles at the pool the day Andy disappeared.
This is stunning. How did you find out this? Who knew this?
There was an archival piece of news footage, local news footage, where Andy's mother told a reporter that the police had told her there were 5 known pedophiles at the pool the day Andy disappeared. And that had been corroborated by police officers. So then, of course, the natural question for me was, well, who were these 5 known pedophiles at the pool that day? And if the police knew where they were there, why didn't anybody tell those kids that were swimming unsupervised in the pool?
Or go look for those pedophiles
once
one of them goes missing.
It's just mind-boggling and incredible. I couldn't believe that there may have been a community of pedophiles in the area, but then at the same time, I have to say it made perfect sense. Here were hundreds of children, unsupervised, on a daily basis.
And you're realizing that they could have been targets for someone like Wayne Chapman, who could have been at that pool. Melanie Perkins' film about the disappearance of her friend Andy is up for an Emmy Award Monday night. When we come back, Melanie finds a man who says he was with Andy the day he was abducted. Later in the program, back to Bailout Nation. We'll have more in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from filmmaker Melanie Perkins. Her Emmy-nominated documentary, Have You Seen Andy, tells the story of the disappearance of her friend Andy Puglisi from the public swimming pool across from the housing project where they both lived in Lawrence, Massachusetts, back in 1976. The Emmy winner for investigative journalism will be announced Monday night. The film comes out on DVD in October. And a warning again, this conversation, it's tough to have. Melanie, before the break, we were talking about Wayne Chapman. He was a suspect in Andy's disappearance, but he was never charged. And you examined many of the possible reasons police departments weren't working together. But also, it may have been easier to convict Chapman, as he was, for the rapes of 2 other boys from Lawrence. These were boys you also knew, and they were taken by Chapman from the same swimming pool where Andy disappeared. In your film, there's an audio tape that was discovered after Chapman's arrest. Here is Wayne Chapman recording his own voice as he drives and stalks children, some of them on school buses.
School bus just passed me with a load of kids. I wonder if there's any boys in there. There comes two boys now. One of them look pretty good there.
Now, where's Wayne Chapman today?
He is currently at a correctional facility in Shirley, Massachusetts, the Susan Baranowski facility. He was sent back to prison last year under a civil commitment. His criminal sentence had actually ended.
There are other people in your film. You meet a young man who says that at the age of 4, he was with Andy at that pool in 1976. Both of them were lured into the woods by a man who looked like Wayne Chapman, asking for help in finding a puppy. Cautionary tale there for parents, to remind parents of that. He says he saw Andy attacked by those two men, but he was so traumatized he didn't tell anyone for 6 years. Now, you know, someone say, well, why do you believe him? People contacted you about this young man with a tip at your P.O. box. But something else that happened seemed to corroborate for you his story. What was that?
Well, that's one of the things that I think is the benefit of making a film like this over time, because sometimes information just can't come out all at once. And with the boy who I believe witnessed Andy's abduction, Ray Clark, I had gotten information from people that said Ray had been there that day and what he had witnessed. I had seen an article in a newspaper that said a boy was interviewed by the Lawrence police who claimed to have seen something. And he did tell somebody when it first happened. He told his mother. But for some reason, his mother decided not to go to the police. I don't know if it was because of all the attention or because she was scared for him. I don't really know. At 10 years old, this little boy started to have trauma nightmares about what had happened, and he finally confided in a teacher, and the teacher got him help, and he was hospitalized over this. I mean, he even gave me access, if I wanted it, to his hospital records to show that he had been saying since 10 years old this is what happened to him. One day, my editor and I were working. She was upstairs transcribing an audio tape we were using of Wayne Chapman.
And to hear it clearer, you had taken it and digitized it.
Exactly. And we thought that Wayne Chapman was saying he took the boy from the pool with a towel.
And by the way, this was during an interview when he was under the effects of sodium pentothal?
That's correct, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the editor came downstairs to talk to me, Rachel Clark, and said, you know, he's saying he took the boy from the pool with a much younger child. And the hair on the back of my neck literally stood up, because I had never told Rachel about Ray's story because he wasn't a part of the film at this point.
The man who said that at 4 he was a younger child with Andy.
That's right. And so he was brave and courageous, I think, to come forward, because he had told the story so much as a child and nobody believed him. And today, 30 years later, he's telling the exact same story, and I very much believe him. And I think when I made this film, I sort of set out with this notion, you know, if this could help one kid, it would make all the difference in the world. And as I was finishing up the film, and we had the screening the night we did in Lawrence, and Ray was there, and all of these neighborhood friends came up to him and thanked him for being so brave, I realized that we had helped one kid because he finally was believed.
Well, and it might help many others because you explain the modus operandi again. You know, we've heard it, but you explain it again. It, you know, will be someone maybe with a police badge, a fake police badge.
Which Chapman did.
Asking kids to help them look for a puppy.
I think one of the things that really was stunning for me in making this film was that I initially thought, as many people did, that, you know, Andy was abducted by this lone pedophile who sort of preyed on children and what have you. And what I ended up finding out that was Wayne Chapman was part of a community, that pedophiles hang together, that they're actually groups, you know, that there's, I didn't realize that NAMBLA, which is the North American Man Boy Love Association, was started right here in Revere just, you know, a year or two after Andy disappeared. It was founded right here. I went to the local police and I said, wait a minute, there's a community of pedophiles here in Lawrence, or there was in the 70s when Andy disappeared. They said, no, these are, you know, sort of the trench coat guy in the alley. And I went to state police and I said the same thing and they said no. And it wasn't until I went and talked with the people at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the FBI, and they looked at me like I was telling them something they had known for 40 years. And of course they worked together. And now they have computers and they can do it even better.
So you're informed and you've laid all of this out in a film, but you never found Andy.
Yet. Hmm. Yet. I believe that we will find Andy someday. I believe, and I have believed ever since I was a little girl, that Andy Puglisi is buried behind the state pool in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And if we could just get the authorities to do what we've been asking them to do for the past 8 years, I believe we will find him. And we've asked that they do a systematic grid search to look for this little boy. And we've been told everything from there are not enough resources to we've looked, you know, a dozen times to...
They have done some digging.
They've done some digging, but it's been very sporadic. As somebody else has said, as Dr. Meyer, Anne Marie Myers, forensic anthropologist at the State Medical Examiner's Office, has made a wonderful metaphor. It's like taking a handful of marbles and throwing them across a table. And there's swaths of area on the table that's not going to be covered. And that's how it is. It's not a big area. It's a 1 mile area, 1.5 mile area. Do a grid search. Map it out. You know, if it was my child, I would insist on that. And I've tried so hard for the past 8 years to have that happen. And I would love to see that happen. But, you know, I don't think Andy's story is over yet. He's going to be found. And the thing is that when I started this film, I knew nothing more than what a 9-year-old girl knew had happened to her friend that day. And today, I know much more than I could ever have wanted to know, literally. I know too much, I think, about that day. But that's what I set out to do, is to find out what happened to him. And now I know what happened to him. I didn't realize that I was going to feel responsible to have to do something about it.
That's Melanie Perkins. She wrote and directed the documentary Have You Seen Andy? It's nominated for a National Emmy Award in the investigative journalism category. Melanie, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, when we come back to the economy. After the news, here and now. Well, who's next in the breadline? As we've been hearing today, the Bush administration is proposing bailing out bad mortgage securities. Well, might the auto industry be next? Detroit's big three automakers have been working the halls on Capitol Hill for congressional approval of $25 billion in federal loans for their struggling industry. The funds were set up under the yet-to-be-passed energy bill to help GM, Ford, and Chrysler meet the bill's mandate to retool and produce more fuel-efficient vehicles. But now the automakers are pushing for the funds to be released under a separate spending bill so that they can get their hands on it. Will the money make a difference? And wait a minute, bailing out a car company, haven't we been here before? Barry Ritholtz runs Fusion IQ, an equity research firm in New York. He writes the blog The Big Picture and joins us from the NPR studios in Manhattan. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's let the candidates weigh in on this. Barack Obama has long been an advocate of the loan program for the car industry, and last month, John McCain reversed his opposition and came out for this loan program. Not really a surprise, Barry, given that these benefits are really going to go to the battle states, Michigan and Ohio.
You know, if you look at the history of these bailouts in the United States, they, by major coincidence, always seem to happen in an election year.
Well, let's take us back to 1979, which was the Chrysler bailout. Chrysler near collapse after the 70s energy crunch. The Chrysler gas guzzlers were suddenly looking like dinosaurs. Congress responded with $1.2 billion in loans. But that was considered a success. Tell us at least what happened in the short term.
It's considered a success because eventually Chrysler got bought by Mercedes, and the taxpayer was made whole. But I've been arguing that that's really the wrong standard as to determining if it's been successful or not.
Well, wait a minute. There was more than that. Chrysler repaid the loans. Lee Iacocca, you know, engineered its recovery. He appeared on the cover of Time magazine as Detroit's comeback kid. Not only did he repay the loans, but it said that the government actually made some money, $300 to $400 million extra, you know, in the deal. And the company then came out with a K-car line of smaller vehicles, the Dodge Aries, the original minivan. So, you know, it was seen as a success in the short run.
Well, in the short run, certainly. Although I'm a big automobile fan and I frequently go to collectors' museums and things like that, and I've never seen a K-car in any of these museums. But put that aside a second and think about, are we defining success as merely not going out of business? Is that our definition of success? When you look at the broader picture, you see there are a lot of ramifications from that bailout, and we have no control group. We have no alternative universe that says what would have happened had Chrysler been allowed to succumb to their own missteps.
And what do you think would have happened?
Well, we can hypothesize about a couple of things. First, we know for a fact that the market share in the United States of the big three automobile makers has been cut in half since, just about half since the Chrysler bailout. So when you take a macro perspective and say, what's the net result? Hey, they're half the companies in the U.S. that they used to be.
And they're failing again.
Look, when you look at the history of the automobile industry, there was a very, very difficult contract negotiation in the 1950s, everybody was booming after World War II. Soldiers were coming home, buying houses. People were buying cars left and right. And the management of the big three essentially kicked the can down the road and signed onto a comprehensive union agreement that turned out to be a terrific agreement for the unions, but terrible for the big three and ultimately terrible for the unions because of the ultimate downsizing of the big three. So you end up with a situation that the 1950-something accord comes home to roost in the late 70s. We had the oil issue. Prices had spiked. The United States was making big, ugly, very inefficient, and very poorly constructed automobiles, and for the longest time was in denial about it. And my argument has been that it's almost a shame we didn't let Chrysler go belly up, because it would have caused a tremendous reaction both from the executives at GM and Ford, from the unions, and then from the investors who would have stepped in after Chrysler had died.
Well, your point is that if Chrysler had collapsed, investors would swoop in and reconstitute the company, make it smaller, maybe learn faster, maybe change their attitude toward fuel efficiency and manufacturing quality sooner than they have. And, it when you look at Chrysler in 79 with the dinosaur-like gas guzzlers, you can't help but think that the auto industry today was so slow in recognizing that SUVs were going to be trumped by, you know, foreign-made hybrids.
Remember, the automobile industry isn't monolithic. There were lots of people within the various companies agitating for change, saying we have to compete with Honda, which was really one of the first penetrators, and Datsun and Toyota, and come up with better design, more mechanically apt, more efficient vehicles. My suspicion is, and I call this the bearded Spock universe. If you're a fan of Star Trek and you remember back in the early seasons, Kirk and Spock end up going to an alternative universe where that Spock has a beard. So in the bearded Spock universe of automobiles, the assumption is that a number of these agitators would have gotten together with venture capitalists and vulture investors and picked up from the ashes of Chrysler all their valuable assets, their intellectual properties, their manufacturing plants, and then they would have had this new company without the legacy contract that was so ruinous, without the unions. And what it would have forced happening in Detroit, the UAW would have been really forced to do a gut check and say, maybe we need to cut a deal. Hey, let's give up the pension and the health care in exchange for 25% of ownership of the company.
Well, or maybe the unions wouldn't have had to give up that much if, as you're saying, the government didn't step in and save the industry. Instead, the market course-corrected the industry, made it make more reliable cars sooner, and the industry would be flourishing.
Well, they had two problems. They made crappy products. And secondly, they had a structure, a cost structure, that just wasn't competitive with what we saw overseas. You know, it's not only just the unions, though. Understand, I think a collapse of Chrysler would have really put the fear of God into the senior management at GM and Ford. And maybe I'm too optimistic and maybe I'm giving them too much credit. But one would hope that there'd sort of be that eureka moment where people would turn around and say, geez, we're making these dinosaurs. They're ugly. They get terrible gas mileage. They don't last very long. And we're going to lose our shirts if we don't completely rethink the way we do business.
So are you saying that you're willing to just let the auto industry perhaps go the way of shoe manufacturers in New England?
No, what I'm saying is that the United States government shouldn't really be in the business of the lender of last resort to struggling industries. That's not their role. If this was a good bet, there is actually, despite the credit crunch, despite the mayhem on Wall Street, there is actually a ton of cash around. Venture capital firms and private equity firms and sovereign investment funds have not billions, but trillions of dollars. And if this was a decent bet, somebody on the private sector side would find its way to lending some money to GM and Ford.
That's Barry Ritholtz. He's CEO and director of the New York equity research firm Fusion IQ. He writes the blog The Big Picture and is author of the forthcoming book Bailout Nation, How Easy Money Corrupted Wall Street. And Barry, we understand that that book is going to be put off a little while because you're having to write chapters as fast as you can.
This is going to be like a Dostoevsky type of book that I'll be writing for the rest of my life at this pace.
Barry Ritholtz, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, everyone take a deep breath. You're listening to Here and Now. And as we reported earlier, it was announced today that the Treasury Department will begin to at least temporarily guarantee money market mutual funds. Now, until now, these funds, unlike, say, your bank savings account, weren't insured by the government, but they were long considered a safe place to put money. And then came this week's bad news, and on Wednesday, frightened investors pulled $90 billion out of their money market mutual funds. Yesterday, Boston-based Putnam Investments announced it was freezing one fund for the first time in Putnam's history to keep it from collapsing. Kimberly Blanton of the Boston Globe joins us. Kimberly, a mutual fund is simply a way of people pooling their money, and it's then invested by a fund manager. But tell us more. What is a money market mutual fund, and who invests in it?
Well, we all invest in money market funds, whether we're a corporation who needs someplace to put their cash when they sell a widget or a computer. My mother invests in money market funds, so everybody's in them. But I think the most interesting thing about them is that they've really exploded in size over the last 30 years. When I was a kid, my parents put their money in the bank. And around the 70s and 80s, when interest rates started going up, the money markets offered higher interest rates.
Well, then let's just stop you for a second to explain what they are. What do they invest in? And what makes them different from, let's say, investing in stocks?
Well, they're usually invested in bonds, but they're invested in very short-term bonds, and they're called notes. And there are three things they can invest in. They can invest in your city or state government bonds, which are tax-exempt. They can invest in a U.S. Treasury bond, or, and these are the ones that are getting in trouble right now, they can invest in corporate bonds.
But outside of the corporate bonds, these money market funds were considered safer because they were investing in things like your town or your government.
Yeah, and even the corporate ones were considered very safe because these were really only the highest rated securities were going into these, which are already really considered very, very safe.
So it was considered a safe bet, better interest rate. You made more money on them than your bank account. And we understand that fund operators tried to keep the funds at least at their original worth, a dollar a share. And now these funds are starting this week to break the buck. What does that mean?
Everybody pretty much took for granted that your money market, if you bought 1,000 shares in a money market fund, they were worth $1,000, a dollar each. And what's happened this week because of so much strain on these money market funds, and this has not happened probably more than once or twice in history before this week, they're saying, look, you're going to have to take a hit on your money market. And it's turning into a little more like a stock. You could actually lose money on it. And some of these funds are reducing their share prices to 97 cents, 91 cents a share, rather than the sacred $1 a share.
That's the breaking the buck, going below the dollar to the 90s. So as you wrote today, instead of a run on the bank, we saw this run on the money market funds this week. Now, Putnam, based here in Boston, was the only firm to shut down one of its funds. This is a corporate fund primarily because corporations were calling in and asking for their money back. Putnam also was able to keep the shares at a dollar. They said, you spoke to Chief Executive Robert Reynolds, and he said that this was the point, to stem the bleeding of funds out. But what do they plan to do now?
Well, they basically had to freeze the fund because they couldn't sell the holdings in the fund, the securities in the fund, fast enough because the requests for redemptions were coming in so fast. So by freezing it, they said, hold on, everybody. We have got to have a little more time to sell the securities. These are very, and they made clear these were very safe securities. It's just they didn't want us to have to sell them at a loss. So they said, this is the best thing for our shareholders. And actually, a lot of people lauded them for that, to taking this extraordinary step that could even hurt their reputation a little bit.
Is it a little bit like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life? I always go back to that. When there was the run of the bank, and he said, wait a minute, everybody, this money isn't here. This money is invested over here, and it's invested over there. I mean, has Putnam sort of done that in a way?
Yes, they have done that. But, you know, Wall Street is so much more complex than it was back in the 1930s. And I think we're seeing the results of that complexity now. A lot of people don't really understand it, but we're now beginning to understand the fallout from it.
Well, so now we have the federal government stepping in and saying that they will back these money market funds in the way that they back, let's say, your bank account up to $100,000 if a bank fails. Do analysts think that that's going to sort of stave off the run on the funds?
Well, I think yes. I mean, if you've got the federal government stepping in, this is a depression-style guarantee, and this is a really big announcement today. The financial system, whether it's money market funds or a banking account back in the 30s, it's all about confidence. And when you've got Treasury Secretary Paulson saying, everybody calm down, we're going to guarantee the money market funds, that should go a long way to helping with the situation with the money market funds, and I hope it does.
Kimberly Blanton, reporter for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Well, looky here, it's September 19th. You know what day that is. Arg. Back in a minute, here and now.
Sports. Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The sun came up over the Spanish Sea, our homeland far behind us, being hunted by the King's Navy, I'm sure he'll never find us. Pull away, me lads of the Cardiff Rose, and hoist the Jolly Roger.
Yes, arg, don't just stand there like a bunch of bilge rats, grab some grog and do a hornpipe. I don't do it very well, but with all the economic news, it would be easy to overlook that it is also annual Talk Like a Pirate Day. That was the Cardiff Rose from the Talk Like a Pirate website. Today we want to take a look at the bravest, most fierce and daring of the pirates, the women. Author Jane Yolen's new book is Sea Queens, Women Pirates Around the World, 13 biographies of seafaring women from Artemisia of Persia in 480 BC to Madam Ching of China, who made a brief appearance in the third Pirates of the Caribbean film, even though, no, actress Keira Knightley's Elizabeth Swann character was not a real character from history. Jane Yolen joins us in the studio. And do people always say ahoy to you?
No, but they do say, ah.
Oh, very good. What is your interest in pirates? Because this isn't your first book.
No, I have been in love with pirates since I read, as a child, the first picture book I ever read by myself was called The Pleasant Pirate.
Well, and I'm wondering, pirates weren't all that pleasant.
No. As much as we enjoy talking about pirates and playing at being a pirate, they really were not the people you wanted to have over for dinner. Well, that's not entirely true. I think that Granny O'Malley might have been fun. From Ireland might have been fun to have for dinner. And in fact, she had tea with Queen Elizabeth I.
Well, that's just one of the amazing stories in your book. And we should say your previous books, Pirates in Petticoats in 1963 and The Ballad of the Pirate Queens in 1995, are great primers for this book, which goes deeper, way deeper into the female pirate lore. Let's stay with Granny O'Malley. How is it that she came to have tea with the Queen?
Well, she was of an Irish seafaring family, the O'Malleys. The problem for the Irish was that the English were not letting them go and trade in the kinds of ports that they would like to, so they turned to piracy. They were very successful.
Yeah, the English tried many times to kill her.
That's right.
And couldn't get her.
That's right. But when she was 63, she decided it was time to retire. So what she did was she wrote to Queen Elizabeth I, one queen to another. She was known as the Irish Pirate Queen. And she said, basically, I will be willing to hang up my sword and put aside my blunderbusses if you will see to it that my son, who is in prison, is released and will not come after me for past offenses and give me some kind of a pension. And Elizabeth liked that. I mean, liked the fact that she was feisty, another feisty woman. So she sent her a list of, I think it was 16, 18 questions, and liked the answers she got. So she invited her to come for a visit.
And Queen Elizabeth sort of gave her what she wanted, and you got the feeling...
Made her a lady.
Yeah, and you got the feeling that Queen Elizabeth, you know, was quite taken, as many women of the day might have been, with the lives that these female pirates led.
Kind of freedom,
yeah,
for women that they didn't have otherwise.
But we should say, though, that a lot of what you write about and a lot of what these female pirates did to, you know, rule their ships was not pretty. I mean, there were a lot of heads being lobbed off.
There was murder. There was stealing, obviously. They were taking, they weren't taking jewels. We have this thing that pirates were always having chests full of jewels and doubloons and gold, and mostly they were sailing to get bolts of cloth, different kinds of foodstuffs, other ships.
Building their fleet.
They were building up a fleet, exactly.
Well, and there was also, on the part of some of the women, a touch of revenge. You take us through Artemisia, the Admiral Queen from Persia, then there's Queen Tuta, the Terror of the Adriatic, Afhild in Denmark, so beautiful she hid her face so as not to stun other men. I think she killed a few herself. And this goes to the image that we have of pirates, and women could more than hold their own with those murderous pirates. But you remind us that there was a sort of another view of pirates back then. They were, in many ways, the only democratic organizations on ships, and they were respected in some ways.
The navies in those days were incredibly hierarchical, and you had to be very rich to be in the, you know, the captain, the mate, that sort of thing. But on pirate ships, they signed something called articles that spelled out exactly their share of the loot, what they had to do, what things were off limits, and they could vote off the captain.
Well, the stories you tell of the women who made their way on these pirate ships are truly just remarkable. There's Pretty Peg. She was actually English, married to a Dutchman, who was almost killed in a fight till she, like, you paint a scene, and it happens in other places, too, of women just kind of rolling their eyes and saying, oh, let me do this. And she came through and saved her husband.
Yeah, Grania did the same thing. She was in just given birth to her son, and the ship that she was on was attacked, and the men were doing badly. And they came running down to her cabin, and they said that they were about to lose the ship. And she just simply, in whatever nightgown she was still wearing, this is a day after giving birth, she picked up her guns, she picked up her sword, and she went out and she led her men to victory.
Well, let's take Madam Ching, as you write, one of the most successful pirates in the world. I
mean, well, not one of the most successful.
Why?
Because she had 50, 60,000 men and 2,000 ships under her command. She had a naval fleet.
Well, and let's look at some of Madam Ching's rules. A man who goes alone on shore will have his ears slit in the presence of the entire fleet. A repeat of that action, he'll be executed. She's another tough, just tough.
Very tough cookie. But I think that's what kept that fleet together.
Well, and she brought reform. Because
yes.
I'm looking at one of the rules. Under Madam Ching, captured women and children will no longer be hanged by their hair from the ships. And that's a good thing.
I would think so.
Yes. Did the female pirates dress the way we think of pirates?
Well, first of all, it would be much more comfortable on board ship. The men of the days had those fairly loose legged trousers and very full blouses. So a woman could wear that with mm-hmm. ease, and maybe a kerchief around the head if you had long hair. Whether or not they actually got away with not being known to be women is another question. In those days, there weren't bathrooms on board ship, so people just,
There you go, right, where you were.
Well, hanging yourself off the side of the ship.
Okay.
But most of the women who became pirates, they were known within the crew.
And that just speaks volumes, because you got to think that no self-respecting group of pirates is going to let themselves be led by a woman unless she was doing a pretty darn good job.
One of my favorite stories is Anne Bonny and Mary Read. They were friends, two women aboard the same ship. And the men were all down below drinking, playing cards with some men that they had just captured. And the only two, looking out to see what was going on outside were Anne Bonny and Mary Read. Let me read this, because it's one of my favorite moments. The captain of the ship at that point was a man named Calico Jack Rackham. But he was down there drinking with the turtle fishermen, too. The women called down the hatch for help, and when the men refused, Anne fired a blast down, killing one pirate and injuring several others. Then shoulder to shoulder, she and Mary prepared to battle the man of war. But, of course, the women were quickly overpowered, and all the pirates were taken and brought to trial. While they were in prison, Anne was allowed to visit Jack. She reputedly said, "I'm sorry to see you there. But if you had fought like a man, you need not be hanged like a dog."
Fought like a man like she did.
Yes.
Jane Yolen, her new book is called Sea Queens, Women Pirates Around the World. And Jane, thanks so much.
I have one last thing to say.
Please do.
Get off the poop deck.
Thanks so much.